And you got Big Dave here in the Rockabilly Roadhouse coming at you on the Crush 95.9 and streaming around the world at krsh.com. And I got to tell you, I got someone very special on the line right now. Drummer extraordinaire from the Stray Cats. Would you welcome, please, right here on the Rockabilly Roadhouse, Slim Jim Phantom. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing good. How about you, Big Dave?
I'm doing great. I'm thrilled to have you here. Thrilled to have you here. I think you just came off the road. You were in Europe for a while, huh?
Yes, I've been gone for like 2 months, and I couldn't tell you. And the immortal words, Chuck Berry. I'm so glad I'm living in the USA.
That's it, man. Hamburg.
Everywhere else is cool, but I'm happy to get back.
Great, man. You've been in LA a long time, right?
Yeah, I moved to LA in 82.
82, great. So I got to tell you something. I'm an old Long Islander myself, and I grew up a few towns away from you in Belmore, and I used to spend a lot of time running around Massapequa.
You're a Belmoron.
Definitely a Belmoron. Yep, that's what all our buddies call ourselves. I'm going to be up near Niagara Falls in a little while. We're all going to get together, some of the old guys, play some music around the lake.
Man, we did a lot of stuff in Belmore. The Stray Cats probably played Belmore more than anywhere else, really. We used to do, Arrows.
Right.
That was up by the train station, and we did BJ's Lounge on Merrick Road.
Okay.
Every week for a year.
Was the Music Box still open then in Belmore?
Yes, I think the Music Box was there, yeah. I think that was on Merrick Road, too, actually.
Right.
That was more of a rock place, from what I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, more of the Grateful Dead bands over there. There was a venue, I don't know if it was on Merrick Road. Didn't you guys used to play out there? And was it Massapequa? There was a venue right in town there?
We used to do Tuesdays at Arrows. That was by Belmore Train Station. Wednesdays, we did a place that was way out east of Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Thursdays, we did one called Authors.
Oh, yeah, Arthur's. I remember that one, sure.
Fridays was TK's Lounge on Route 110 in Amityville.
Right.
And I think we used to do Saturdays there, too. But we didn't really play the established rock clubs because what we were doing was too weird. It wasn't punk rock. It wasn't, it obviously wasn't Southern Fried Rock, which is what they loved there, heavy metal. It wasn't that. It was too weird for anything. But we had a very nice following of like regular kids, tough kind of gang, you know, that would just follow us. Every night we played, we had 100, 200 people follow us everywhere to these corner bars that weren't really live music venues. They were more like, the owner, operator, guy who was there in the afternoon with an apron, wiping the bar down, that kind of joint, you know. And we would bring all our gear there, and we just made up our own scene, really.
Now, this is, how long were you together? You formed in what, 79 with Brian and Lee?
Yeah, this would have been
right
the whole year of 1979, yeah.
And how long were you in the island before you went over to London?
We went to London June of 1980. So a good year, at least, of really honing our craft and, four sets a night, five nights a week on Long Island.
And it was the rockabilly thing that is what you were doing, like the Gene Vincent thing. I know a big influence on you is the fabulous drummer Dickie Harrell, right?
Oh, yeah. Dickie Harrell was my buddy, and really my that was one of the thrills being with the Stray Cats. Is we eventually met all of our heroes, and Dickie Harrell I stayed with. I went to see him not really before he passed. Went to Norfolk, Virginia, and hung out with him, and he was definitely my buddy. We had a nice connection and spoke quite often, and I loved the guy.
He was only
Influence on everybody.
And the look of that classic album cover, and he was standing up, and that's kind of like how you got your ideas to be a stand-up drummer, just stripped down just the way it should be?
Yeah, and at this time, we were definitely looking to do something different, and that was one of the things. There were a lot of big drum kits at that time. Let's try to make a small drum kit, and then how could we push it further? We had put the drums in the front of the stage, so there was no back line. Everyone played right across the front, which I never knew any band that had done that before.
Right.
And then we stood up to play the drums, and it was definitely influenced by seeing Bebop Dickie Harrell standing up. And then when I met him years later, I told him that story, because we still really the only evidence we had to go on was a few albums that we managed to get, which were ironically that we had to get on imports, even though they were American records. because they'd gone out of print, a lot of them, in the States, and it found their way to England, and we're buying Gene Vincent records as imports. So, and then Dickie smiled a little bit and said, "Slim Jim, I only did that one when we took the photograph."
Oh, okay. So he played traps occasionally, too. I mean, it wasn't just a stripped-down set.
Yeah, I think more than not, yeah.
Did you ever play traps, or you always liked the snare and the
oh,
and
I
the
always
drum.
Played a traditional style. All the Stray Cats, we all took lessons and learned how to play properly. And now, if you do a session, or if I'm practicing, you tend to sit down.
Yeah.
You don't really have a stand up kit in your living room and jump on the bass drum or anything. You just kind of like you say for the big shows when you practice and when you learn. Learn something, you're sitting down at a regular drum kit.
Was Lee always playing a stand-up, the doghouse bass, or did he play
Lee started out electric bass, like all of us, because that's how he took lessons. And he's an excellent musician. He read and write music, and very, very talented guy.
Yeah, he's been up here a few times, got to see him. And I don't know, have you been up in this area, in the North Bay? I don't know if you've ever played. We're going to be seeing you at Rancho Nicasio. It's going to be fabulous.
Yes,
Bob
sure.
Brown and Andrew Lestrelli hosting up there on Sunday, August 13th. It's going to be great, and you'll have Red Meat and Mitch Polzak opening up for you guys. It's going to be a hoot. But have you been up here?
Because
I haven't seen
there.
What's that?
I would love to come and play more.
Yeah, you
are
should.
Are there other clubs up there? I'd love to come play more.
Well, I'll see what I can do for you. In fact, and we'll talk about Headcat and Lemmy, which I just love, and I was listening, driving over to the station this morning. I know you and Lem were like best buds, and I can't play it enough on the Rockabilly Roadhouse. We're one of the only commercial radio stations in the United States playing Headcat, and I don't let a week go by without playing you, buddy.
Oh, that's awesome. That was a very, very special thing that hopefully turns everybody on to something that I knew very well, is that Lemmy he was a rockabilly boy.
Yeah.
Although his regular band, you might not be able to tell by first listen, but he loved Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Gene Vincent, and he knew Jerry Lee. He knew that stuff better than anyone I really knew.
Yeah, I know. I mean, just hearing him do Bad Boy or any of those songs, and You Can't Do That, and the Beatles stuff,
Beatles,
and just
sure.
Just fabulous. But so you're running around Long Island. I know, Takapusha Reserve and All American Hamburger Drive-In and the Pequot Theater. You guys must have been tearing it up over there.
Oh yeah, we were local boys. Yeah, that's where all those places we played. Massapequa Little League, and went in the woods to Takapusha and ate All American, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, chasing the Mr. Softy truck, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
So Eddie Cochran obviously was a big influence on you too, and in his group, and obviously he died way too soon. But I know you love Eddie, right?
Yeah, Eddie Cochran to me was really the best rock star. He looked great.
Yeah,
played great. He sang great. I think he was way ahead of the curve in a technological thing with the sounds of those records, and he kind of left behind an image that's frozen in time, really.
Right. Right, yeah.
So you'll never have to see Eddie Cochran and what he would have done in the 70s, or how he would have made a living, or what he would have had to have done. You can just imagine it.
Right.
And you've got that classic image of him just, frozen and a catalog. How did he get all that done in such a short amount of time?
I don't know. He wrote a lot. He had a cousin, didn't he? They were the Cochran brothers. But I don't know, were they related, or they're just both with the same name?
I think they called it that. Yeah, the Cochran brothers. He did that before he branched out on his own.
Okay. All right. And what about Johnny Burnett before he got into the whole crooner thing? I just love Johnny Burnett. And the Rock and Roll Trio, for me, and Coral Records, is just stamped in my head. And I'm sure you're, those guys were just phenomenal.
Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio, Dorsey Burnett on drums, Paul Burleson, and another guy named Joe Mathis were the two guitar players that had given credit on those records. Paul Burleson is the known one. I think some of their sessions were done by a guy named Jody Mathis.
Okay.
And I think more than anyone, he was the one that really affected the British Invasion Cats. I mean, I know the Yardbirds recorded Train Kept a Rollin', and I do know, speaking with all those guys, Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck, and even our USS guys, Joe Perry, and all the guitar hero, Jimmy Page, is crazy for that stuff. All the Guitar Hero guys, Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio, they were that was their group.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, all these ones are just classics. There's, you know, mm-hmm. just by Johnny Burnett, there's like 15 classic ones, 20 classic ones.
I don't know.
And I like the crooner stuff he did afterwards, too.
Yeah.
And I think Dorsey had a bunch of good records, too.
After he passed away, Johnny, those guys kept going for a while as a unit?
Oh, really? Dorsey did and Paul Burleson?
Yeah. Were those guys still active after after he passed away?
That I'm not 100% sure of.
Yeah.
I do know that Rocky Burnett, who's Johnny's son, had a big hit, Toe in the Line.
Yeah.
Billy Burnett, who's my buddy to this day, he did his thing with Fleetwood Mac and made some excellent solo records.
Yeah, he's great.
I think there's a great tradition of this stuff, man. I really do.
Yeah. Well, yep. Coral Records. Those were the days. So how did you get over to London? What made you guys just jump on a plane? Did you know?
Yeah, we
have a connection going on there.
No, we didn't know anything really. I wouldn't advise anyone as a plan to do what we did, but we were trying to stay hip to what's going on in England. We knew they had punk rock, and there was a bit of style there,
yeah.
more so than on Long Island or even New York City. There was kind of an in-between period there where there wasn't much really going on, and we walked around pink peg pants, blue suede shoes, black and white shirt, hair piled high every minute of every day.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a drag, you know, like it just couldn't exist. It would be constant hassle, really. And we were hearing about, people who had gone there. We would get NME and the Melody Maker, the music mags,
yeah.
a few months late, and just know that there was a scene over there. They had Sex Pistols there. They had Clash there. And they had Teddy Boys that we thought, wow, that would fit right in with what we're doing.
Right.
So in a very youthful and spontaneous thing, we just went there, thinking, oh, we're sure to find someone who will give us a gig. You're not getting enough doors. You do. We could do whatever we want.
Right.
And you just wind up in a foreign city and say, okay, what do you do now? Well, you said it was a good idea. No, you said it was a good idea. We spent quite a few months homeless, sleeping in all-night movie theaters, couch surfing from the kindness of strangers, just anything that we could do
right.
to just stay one day longer. And we knocked on enough doors, and like I said, there is a music scene there. So there was a strong tradition back then of rock and roll pubs, bars that would start at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and have, you know, four or five bands a night till midnight or whatever the license law was.
Right.
And they needed bands. So we knocked on enough doors, we went to enough parties, we followed enough people around that we found the four or five places that you should knock on doors. And that's what we did. And after a while, 6 months of it, maybe, they agreed to let us have a show here. Okay, you go on the Friday night, 4:30 in the afternoon. And we had been hanging around enough that when we finally got a shot, the 20 people that would be there were the hipsters that we had been meeting, trying to crash parties. And that would have been Chrissy Hynde, Joe Strummer, Captain Sensible, Sex Pistols, Clash, the guys from Madness, the guys in Specials, you know, just whoever the 20 people are that went out every night to try to see cool bands kind of thing, you know. And most of the time you didn't see a cool band. But when we played, it was different because we were good. We were different. We had been doing it a year. Mm. We were practicing hard. So when we turned up at the Golden Lion in Fulham to just do a couple of songs in front of a bunch of rock stars, we were ready for it. We weren't a band that formed a week before because everybody looked cool, you know? It wasn't. Word spread pretty quickly because of the music magazines.
Right.
The next week when Strummer would be speaking to Melody Maker, so what'd you do last week? Well, I saw this band from New York, and you wouldn't believe it. And Chrissy Hynde brings a couple of her friends next time, including Ray Davis. He sees it. He speaks with the NME. You wouldn't believe these guys I saw from New York. Holy mackerel.
Reminded
me of Eddie Cochran. And once the wildfire of it spreads like that on a club level,
right.
then we got some more bookings. We did maybe 10, 12 shows around London.
Right.
And one of the nights, the Rolling Stones came. It wasn't the guy from The Clash. It was all of the Rolling Stones came and had a table right in front of the stage.
Wow.
And when the paparazzi gets a picture of you with them and the fact that they were there, then that translates from being in the music magazines to being in the daily newspapers. Like, who are these homeless guys from New York that the Stones went and saw? Immediately, it's a much bigger story. And after that is when all the record companies started to come around.
Now, did Dave Edmunds get involved immediately at that point as a producer with you? Or?
Yes. Well, Edmunds came around to a lot of the shows.
Right.
And we didn't really know what to do. We didn't really know him that well. We got to know him. Yeah. And then when a few of the record companies started talking, who were you thinking about producing it? At first, the Nick and Keith were going to be on their label, and they were going to produce it. But it became very hard to, like, make all that happen again.
Sure.
Like, they all came the one time, and then the next week we would meet with Sir Mick at his place. He would talk about how great it was and what we're going to do. Great. The next week we would speak to Keith, and he would say the same thing at his house.
But right.
To get them all together again to work for Rolling Stones Records seemed very, very hard. And for us, the clock was still going.
Right.
At TikTok, we still had nowhere to live. We still... Part of the best thing was we were meeting at the Rolling Stones. Yeah, yeah, great. But they were also buying us lunch, you know, which was a very important thing.
Yeah.
So at that point, we was speaking to one label in particular. It was Arista, and they were very nice to us, and they, like, got us a place that we could live for a little while.
Mm.
And Edmunds came in strong, and we met with Edmunds, and we really liked the guy, where he was coming from, and he really wanted to do this. He kept saying, you guys are like Elvis and I'm like Sam Phillips. I've been looking for something like this for 20 years, you know?
Wow.
And it just seemed to line up. Like, if he said yes, then Aristide would say yes, then they would pay us, then we could get a flat, and then we could go to the supermarket and make an album. Like,
yeah.
So it all lined up.
So
and,
you first released...
And it was obviously the right thing.
Right. And you the albums first came out in England before they you had the American label. How did that work?
Yes, in England, I think it's the same for everybody. They signed us as if we were UK, a British artist.
Right.
So most English record deals are structured with the world excluding America. It's
right.
called an ex-America contract, because I don't think many labels want to have the commitment of having to try to break a band all over the world. They try, and then if it does okay around the rest of the world, then maybe they'll put a little bit of money into the States,
sure.
Which to tour especially is a much bigger investment, just because it's so much bigger, you
right.
know?
To
get a band from Scotland down to London isn't really that big of a deal, but to get a band from New York to L.A. is kind of a lot more expense, you know?
Yeah.
So we traveled around the world, I think at least twice, before we ever came to the States. Like, we played Paris 15 times. We played Pittsburgh. We played Tokyo at least twice before we ever played Topeka. You know, we went to Australia two times before we ever went to Alabama, that kind of thing.
Right.
So even though we were American, our careers were handled as if we were British artists. And every place we went, it was just undeniable. And then by the time we came back to the States, we had been very good at this, playing a lot.
Right.
So the
right.
same thing happened in America again. We came to L.A. first to do some type of television show, and we just stayed. And the record got released, MTV kicked in. It was the whole perfect storm for the Stray Cats.
You were like Chaz Chandler and Jimi Hendrix. You got to go over to England, and then you come back to America and take it by storm.
Yeah, I can't say that it was planned that way, but that's what did happen.
Right.
And when something like that works, I suppose it's you're a genius. If it doesn't work, then you're a dummy, you know?
Yeah, it's a pipe dream. What was your most memorable moment playing with the Stray Cats?
Oh, the Stray Cats. I think something like the US Festival would be a big one, because we're that was our day. We've been playing, for 3 years at that point. We had been rockabilly. We had brought rockabilly music into the mainstream.
Right.
And we had a hit record going on, and it was all like, this is kind of what we said we were going to do.
Yeah, you sure did.
Way beyond any level you could predict. But when we brought Rockabilly, and when we saw the mannequins in Macy's on Third Avenue wearing bowling shirts, you know, for a brief minute there, Rockabilly was exactly en vogue.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
In the whole American culture, like the ads or the other television shows where they'll have episodes about it, like it really became a mainstream thing.
Right.
For a brief moment, and you know, we're still doing it, but like we did get over.
Yeah, 600,000 600,000 people at the Yes Festival. That was even bigger than Watkins Glen, which is the 50th anniversary this year of that. And you guys had 600,000 people you played in front of at the Yes Festival. So that was wild, man. I remember watching you guys then. So you got to know some of the rock's pioneers like Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis. I know you recorded with Jerry's sister, Linda Gale Lewis, but did you do some stuff? I'm going to lead up to the Blue Suede Shoes of Rockabilly Sessions, one of my favorite television concerts ever. But I don't know if you met Carl before then and Jerry Lee.
Oh yeah, we had known Carl very well before that because one of the great things that had happened with the Stray Cats was that it helped to plug in a lot of those original Rockabilly artists. People like Wanda Jackson, yep. Janice Martin, you know, mm-hmm. people like that who sure. were, it really gave everyone kind of a shot in the arm. Carl was still Carl. He was yep. one of the, you know, the big guys. He was doing okay, but he was on the radar again.
Yeah.
And so was Dave Edmonds as a producer. I think Dave did a record by the Everly Brothers, and I think a bunch of other labels tried to get rockabilly bands to kind of... to maybe make a movement out of it.
Yeah.
But I do know that when Carl did the Blue Suede Shoes sessions, that Lee Rocker and I were chosen to be the rhythm section for it.
Wow.
So Edmonds was the musical director, and he had some of his guys, and we had already met Carl Perkins in like 82, 83, 84. He came and played with Stray Cats quite a bit.
Yeah.
Whenever we were near Nashville. And so it was really just a natural thing for him to say, like, well, what about those Stray Cat boys? And Edmonds was in charge. He says, well, I produced those guys, you know. So they needed a drummer and a bass player for it. So Lee and I were the likely choices.
Wow. Now, you had, I don't know if it was a one-day recording and was different groups, or was it the whole session was all of you guys that, you know, you had Eric and George Harrison and Dave Edmonds, yeah. and Ringo was there too, and so I don't know if you did it all in one big day. And
had about a week of rehearsals, maybe 3-4 days.
I see.
Where they decided who would do what songs, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I remember that being pretty easy to decide, and then I remember us all being in a big rehearsal room, and so everyone was throwing it to the big pot together, and right. just being, you know, very friendly with Georgie became my friend, and we were friends the whole rest of his time, you know, and we're still very close with Olivia.
Oh.
And we went to visit Friar Park back then, and now too, but he just became my friend. I loved him, and he loved Rockabilly so much. Richard too, you know. But it was different because we had been around a bunch. We had played with the Rolling Stones. We kind of knew everybody. But Beatles are different still.
Beatles.
That just makes it different. And they really loved the rockabilly and the whole thing. And the fact that we were vouched for by Carl, that's kind of a big step, you know. He's going to be a drummer. I say he's okay. And Georgie was like, okay, sure.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that's and you could buy that, or I don't know if it's available for streaming, but the Blue Suede Shoes, a Rockabilly Session, 1985. I don't know if that was Cinemax or whoever produced that and released it.
I think it was a Channel 4 in England or ITV. It was like a small thing, too.
Yeah.
It wasn't one of those big Albert Hall or Crossroads guitar show. I mean, it really wasn't. It was kind of like a sleeper almost.
Yeah.
You know? Now it's more famous than it ever was in a funny way.
Yeah, that's crazy.
As usual with me, it's got a cult following.
So you've been over to Friar Park with George's place?
Yeah, yeah.
And is that still in the
Number
family?
Times.
Does Olivia still have that?
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
It looks beautiful.
It's all
there.
The same, even better.
Yeah, that's fabulous, man. So you were married for many, many years to Britt Eklund, actress and model, yeah. And then I believe you, after about 10 years or something, you moved down to the Sunset Strip and you opened up a rock and roll club, which I never been to, called the Cat Club. Is that when you started Head Cat with Lemmy, when everyone started coming down and playing?
Yes. We had known Lemmy many years before in England, because when I was recounting the tales of the early pubs in England, Lem was one of the hipsters that was at the club, and he and I just stayed friends. And he loved rockabilly. He brought me to his basement bunker apartment because I didn't know a certain Gene Vincent song that he had on a reel-to-reel recorded off the BBC when he was a kid. They still knew where the tape was, you know, amongst his, seemingly unorganized flat. He found it right away. And we just stayed friends forever. And then when he moved to L.A. in the early part of the 90s, just by happenstance, he lived right behind me. I'd see him every day, really. And we were very close. And an opportunity arose to do a track for an Elvis tribute album. And I thought, who best to do that but Lem? He loves it. And I also got Johnny Ramone, who was the other dear pal of mine, and the other big Ramones fan, big Elvis fan. So we went and we cut one track. We did Good Rockin' Tonight from the Sun Sessions. And then Lem was finished. Johnny was finished. Okay, I'm going home. He did one song. And then we had the studio booked the whole day. So Lem said, well, let's try this one. Let's try that one. And within the next few hours, we had a few more songs. Lem asked the guy at the studio, you free tomorrow? Guy said, yes. Lem said to me, you want to come back tomorrow? I said, yes. So we just kept going back to the studio for a few weeks, and we had what became the first Head Cat album. Wow. And Lem just loved it, you know, because he got to play that music.
Right.
A lot of these cats, these classic rock cats, they love this music, but their careers haven't really given them the opportunity to actually go play that music.
Right.
For a reason, right?
Right.
So Lem just loved doing it, and that turned into whenever he had a hole in the big Motorhead schedule every year, which is usually around February, March, we would go and do shows, usually the West Coast,
right?
Because we could drive to him, and
exactly.
And so he was just a major part of my life, and he loved that music. And right now, BMG, next week I think it is, or next month, we found two live records that we really cleaned up and that are going to get proper releases on BMG with nice artwork and nice treatment on them.
Fabulous.
So that's nice to see that finally happen. Yeah, he would have been very proud of that.
Yeah. Now, the so the Cat Club was, how long did you have the club for down there?
Cat Club was five bands a night, seven nights a week, I think 16 years.
Is that right? Just never got to go. And that's right on the Sunset Strip there?
Yeah, it was right next door to the Whiskey Go-Go. Like the Whiskey Go-Go, Duke's Coffee Shop, and then the Cat Club.
Now, Danny B. Harvey, he's always been a member of Head Cat as well?
Yes, he was there the day that we did the session, because the session, I think, came through him, and he asked me, and I asked Lem. And then, and very much with Lemmy, how he was, if you're there the first day, you're in.
Now, he was in the Rock Cats, I believe. They came before the Stray Cats, the Rock Cats. Is that right?
That's great, yes. Yes, Danny played with Levi and the Rock Cats. I think he played with the Rock Cats after Levi left. I'm not 100% sure, but I do know that he was a member of the Rock Cats. Yeah.
Okay. Or,
had a few lineups.
I see. Now, in fact, you guys had, there was one opening that you had on a New Year's Eve, could have been New Year's Eve up here, but unfortunately the local venue, Hot Monk over here, had it booked, but it was about 7 years ago. I remember talking to your agent and said, well, we have one availability in New Year's Eve. Unfortunately, I couldn't make that happen, but it would have been great to see Head Cat here. But now you have another version of the band, right? With David Vincent, more of a hard rock guy that's bass and vocals. Is there something going on with that, or was that a one-off show?
That was really what, after Lem passed, we wanted to do a tribute 45 to him.
Oh, I see.
So we did the song with a guy named David Vincent. Yeah, he's like a hard rock guy. He's really good. Texas, guy. But that was more like a one-off thing that Danny Harvey and myself wanted to give a track to Lem's memory.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Now, you wrote an autobiography, which I still need to read. It came out, I believe, in 2016. It's called A Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. Did you enjoy putting that book together?
It's a good one.
Yeah?
It's hard. Writing a book is it's the hardest thing to do because there's no trick to it. It's not one of those things where, say, like writing a song or learning a drum part, you can stare at it and all of a sudden you'll get it.
Yeah.
Or if you knock it around a little bit, I got a song. Ooh, I wrote that song in 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen with a book. With a book, you have to sit there, stare at a blank page every single day. And some days you'll get a few words. Sometimes you'll get a chapter. Sometimes you know, but you got to sit there.
Yeah.
When I finally saw it, like practicing the drums, you just got to do it. You got to sit there. You got to do it for 3 hours. Some days you'll get 2 pages. Some day you'll get 22 pages. Some day you'll get 22 words.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Right.
And that's how I then I wound up liking it. And it's something that I'm very proud of, because I wrote every word myself. I did not have a co-writer or a ghostwriter.
Beautiful.
Well, I'm definitely a thing I'm proud of.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely going to read that now that I know you did write it. I didn't know before, but now I do. Now, the other big milestone, you had the Stray Cats 40 album that came out in 2019. How did that come about? You just decided, hey, it's 40 years, we got to do something, and you did a tour, I believe, at that time, and you put out that album, which I really enjoy, too.
Yeah, the Stray Cats, we always... sometimes it can be quiet amongst everyone for a couple of years, and then it always leads to somebody calling about something, and it usually is a few months of just, you know, talking about, you know, someone from school or, you know, baseball or something funny. And then it eventually leads to someone receiving an offer and then turning into, this one sounds good. Let's see what they can, wrap around that one. And 40 was very much a plan.
Right.
And it started out that we wanted to do something to commemorate 40 years. And those in the business part of it thought that first album came out in 1980. Let's do something for 2020. It's nice round numbers, easy math. And we, the three of us, agreed that, well, we didn't start in 1980. We just didn't appear out of nowhere and make an album. It doesn't work that way. We started in 1979 and really paid our dues. And so we wanted to say, to make that clear. So 1979, 40 years is 2019. So no matter how much we were tried to convince that 2020 is a round number, we wanted the crooked number because it was the truth. So we did an album in 2018, recorded these things before, and it was a very nice process. We did it in Nashville, and we did it in a very workmanlike way. Everyone stayed in a hotel or rented a house or brought their families, and we were there for a month or so. And we would turn up every day at noon. We would work till 4 o'clock, take a lunch break for an hour, 5 o'clock. We'd go back into the studio, work till 9 o'clock. And we did that every day for a month. We took off on Sunday. And it was very, very nice. It was a very different way. The Stray Cats are a bit more haphazard when we were younger. Working at night, working late hours, crazy, you know, interrupting things, go off and do something in between and come back. And but it was really cool, and the record did not very well. Got some of the three in the Billboard charts, and then we did a world tour to commemorate it, and it was a really successful thing. And we did the last show was at the Greek Theater, which is the greatest venue I know of, with my wife's band, Eagles of Death Metal, opened up the show, special guest. So it was really like a beautiful way to cap 40 years.
That's fabulous, Slim Jim. I hear you're working on a rockabilly documentary. Is that something that's in the works, or is that an idea that you started forming?
Yes, that's something that I started to do maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. Started with guys like Charlie Connor, the original drummer with Little Richard, Dickie Harrell, Wanda Jackson, Brenda Lee, people like that, my heroes and my friends, Dwayne Eddy, that we just wanted to talk to and just really document there. And it kind of morphed into something that's more of the history of the genre and the impact on the culture that it's had everywhere. Like there's no Beatles without Buddy Holly. There's no Stones without Chuck Berry. There's no Eddie guy. There's no Who without Eddie Cochran,
sure,
et cetera, you know. So just rockabilly as more of a cultural impact,
right,
on the world, really.
Right.
And we're very deep into it. I think you'll see something next year on the television.
Fabulous.
It seems like it's very, it's going very well.
Good for you. And also, I just want to mention that you have a wonderful show, the Rockabilly Rave Up, at Little Stevens Underground Garage. It's on Sundays. I do listen to that, and you play a lot of great classic straight ahead stuff. And you know, I do my show over here, which is all over the map. I'll throw in surf and doo wop and jump blues and all kinds of crazy stuff and retro stuff. But what you do is just the pure stuff, and a lot of people need to hear that and get to the roots. So the more guys playing this kind of stuff, the better. And that's a fun show. How long have you been doing that on Sirius?
Doing it about 7 years, 5 years. It's got to be.
Wow.
5-7 years. There's another organic thing of meeting Stevie and talking to him just organically. I went to see his band play at the Roxy.
Yeah.
Disciples of Soul, and a friend of mine was in the band, and I got there early, and there was no one in the club except Stevie and me. I got there earlier than the sound check, and my friend was late, and we just sat at a table in the dark at the Roxy. And then, you know, what do you got, kid? First of all, I'm 55, you know? But like, and what do you got? And I just told him the same thing, really. There's no Beatles without Buddy Holly. There's Rolling Stones without Bo Diddley. I got on my high horse. Rockabilly's been so, you know, take it for granted. And it's the purest American art form. And Bob, you know, I got going. And Stevie just sits there and listens. And then when I ran out of steam, he just looked right at me, scratched his chin. He gave me a Silvio. He gave me his best Silvio.
Yeah, love
and
it.
And said, all right, you're in. Have the first show in 2 weeks. So I said, well, why? I'm not. You just asked me. He said, I need something like this. I want you to have, I want it to be you.
Oh.
I gave him the first show in 2 weeks. I've been doing it 7 years later, you know?
I love it. What's the instrumental? Is that a, it wasn't, not an, is a Gene Vincent instrumental? Is that your theme music?
It's Gaibo by Eddie Cochran.
Oh, that is Eddie Cochran. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's a good one, man.
And so we like to bring, I like to play new rockabilly music and show the people that it's not just the classics, and I like to, you know, play a few wild cards and tell you why this is rockabilly, and just give me 2 seconds and I'll be able to tell you why. And that with the classic original American rock and rollers. And it's of everything I do, it's my favorite thing.
And you record that in down in LA?
Yeah, we did it for the longest time at Sirius XM Studios, and then things changed and everyone had to learn how to do it from their home.
Yep.
So luckily I learned to do it from my home, and no one really does it too much at the studio anymore. And they have beautiful offices, so I would like to start going back to the studio. But I've learned how I can do it all over the world.
Sweet.
In a quiet place, nice microphone, and you can do it.
There you go, high in the Hollywood Hills. So you're bringing, you're going to be doing this fabulous show here on Sunday, August 13th. Over at Rancho Nicasio. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah.
It's barbecue on the lawn. They do have all kinds of wonderful groups that come through there every summer, and Bob Brown and Angela Straley and the boys and Mike Duke, they're all out there. But it's going to be the Slim Jim Phantom Trio, Red Meat, some high cholesterol honky tonk music, and Mitch Polzak, one of the tallest men in rockabilly. I don't know if he's as tall as you, but he also plays banjo. So those are the guys opening, and I'm looking forward to seeing the Slim Jim Phantom Trio. And who's in your band, by the way?
Who's in my band is my beautiful wife Jenny V, plays bass, and she plays in a band called Eagles of Death Metal.
Yes,
yeah, the real rock.
Yes,
they're in Australia right now playing, and I think Chris Shiflett will be playing guitar. And we got a whole thing.
Good.
It's going to be a beautiful day. It sounds like an awesome. I'm going to drive up the night before in my Hemi Challenger, and hope there's a few places where I can go fast and.
Yeah,
there we go.
There is. Yeah, it's the back roads of West Marin. You're going to love it. So again, Slim Jim Phantom, man, come see him at Rancho Nicasio Sunday, August 13th. It's the gates open at 2 o'clock and the music starts at 3:00. And it's a rockabilly honky-tonk retro fest. So we're all going to have a blast out there.
I love it.
And I'm looking forward to meeting you in person. It's been a hoot talking to you right here. And keep the dream alive. Keep playing this great music. And we'll leave a light on for you, man.
Thanks, Big Dave.
Slim Jim Phantom, folks, right here in the Rockabilly Roadhouse on The Crush. Catch you soon.